costs. If you were a hospital counting on fee-for-service to get paid in most of 2020, you weren't getting paid because people weren't coming in for the elective surgeries and procedures. But if you had a value-based care model in which you were sharing risk in a value-based arrangement, you were still getting paid. So this is spurring more providers to look into value-based care and value-based contracts moving forward.
All it took was a once-in-a-century pandemic to, you know.
Hello and welcome to HIMSCast, and welcome to the beginning of season two of this podcast, our second full year in operation. Today we're going to be doing some predictions for 2021. Each of the brand leaders who are joining me today have written or are working on a predictions piece covering their particular area of health tech or health finance. And we're going to go over just a few of those predictions and talk a little bit with each other about what we expect to see in the new year. If you're interested in more, as usual, there will be links in the show notes to each of these prediction pieces, as well as some other third-party contributed pieces and reports on reports that we've done over the past couple of months about the future of healthcare this year. So welcome to the show, Susan Morse, Managing Editor at Healthcare Finance News.
Hello.
Laura Lovett, Managing Editor at Mobi Health News.
Hi, happy to be here.
And Mike Milliard, Executive Editor at Healthcare IT News.
Hello.
And of course, as usual, I am Editor-in-Chief Jonah Comstock, your HIMSCast host. So let's start with you, Mike, our flagship editor. What are some of the things that you're predicting or you're expecting to see in 2021 on the health tech front?
Well, obviously the story of 2020, you know, from a health IT standpoint, was telehealth. It certainly came into its own in a huge way by necessity at first, but I think patients really came to like it in the convenience of not having to go to the doctor's office if they don't have to. We've obviously seen a bit of a dip in from those huge numbers in the spring as things got slightly back to normal in the summer. Of course, now the COVID-19 numbers are ramping back up again. We're seeing an uptick again in telehealth. But, you know, I think there's going to be kind of a level setting in 2021 of how that is continues to, be a major, paradigm of care delivery. And I think what's going to happen is different specialties perhaps are going to use it to different degrees. We wrote about a PwC report that says that, the industry is going to be determining which virtual visits make the most sense and where they and how they should take place. You know, the PwC, says telepsychiatry is going to be, a pretty big area. Family medicine, 56%, they say, pediatrics is also, a strong area, but I think there's going to be some decisions that are going to have to take place about when and how and where and, how to optimize it and not just have it be video visits over an iPhone, but, really gain some real data from that and perhaps use some automation or AI technologies to make the most of that data. So I think there's going to be some maturation there for sure.
And we're really talking here about telehealth after the pandemic, right? As well as we continue to fight through it. And so some of these questions about which areas it'll be most used in are questions about where telehealth has really proven in the course of its required usage to actually be maybe an upgrade in various ways to in-person care.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with Mike. It seems that behavioral virtual health seems to be a no-brainer with everybody agreeing because before to get care, people were waiting in hospitals or waiting for a phone call anyway to talk with a behavioral health provider. So that seems to be something that will stick around.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things going on there. One is that just in general, this pandemic has sort of created a sub-pandemic of mental health. It's been really hard on people's mental health. Some of the follow-on effects from it, like layoffs and you know, losing people and becoming sick are also, you know, triggers of mental health. But also, I really do think, you know, we've all become so used to communicating the way we're communicating right now over Zoom that it's less of a stretch to do that with a therapist or a counselor. So there's a lot of things pointing to that becoming a real norm in that business, I think.
Yeah, we ran another piece from Frost and Sullivan just this week that predicts that 1 in 3 patient interactions will be going virtual, you know, worldwide. You know, they said 35% of patient interactions will be digital in 2021 compared to 20%, you know, currently, because, you know, providers are going to have to focus on what they call a hyper-connected audience. You know, folks are just so used to having these smartphones in their pockets, and I think that's just only going to, you know, continue to gain steam.
Yeah. I'm planning to do my own show, a separate show on this in a few weeks, but I've come to the conclusion, I think, that one thing to watch for is that what they call virtual care sort of encompasses chronic condition management, sort of the Livongo and Omada stuff, is sort of going to be the new telehealth as telehealth becomes table stakes. That's going to be what we're, you know, fighting for adoption for and for, you know, provider and patient comfort with. And so that, I think that's going to be a really interesting space to watch in 2021 to see what trajectory that takes and whether it takes another pandemic for that to come to the same level of use that telehealth came to in 2020. Hopefully not.
Yeah, actually, that's one of Moby's predictions. We're talking a lot about one-stop shop for, you know, digital care. And so you're looking at that Livongo Teladoc. Definitely, that's a deal that we've watched in terms of, you know, people going for chronic care management. Maybe there's going to be a lot of crossover with telehealth as well. So you're seeing a provider, you're also getting that managed care through maybe an app. And then, I mean, there's a lot of rumors out there that this isn't just a Livongo Teladoc, but like you said, Omada Amwell. I talked to Roy Schoenberg, who's the CEO of Amwell, and he would not give anything away on that front, but there have been a lot of rumors around that. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we see more and more of that and more mergers to look for that. The other thing, too, is I think big tech's going to start looking in that space, and they're going to start saying, you know, maybe there's an Amazon who's already doing a lot with digital pharmacies. Are they going to get into something like chronic care management? Will they get into telehealth? And I think we're going to see competing from these huge telehealth giants to maybe these big tech companies. So I think that one-stop shop is definitely something we're going to see in the next few years.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to get more careful with our language in terms of the telehealth, telemedicine distinction, because I think a lot of this stuff is sort of technically part of telehealth, but we still sometimes use telehealth to talk about, you know, just video visits, which I think increasingly is going to be sort of an outdated way to think about it.
Oh, yeah. Remote patient monitoring is going to be, you know, huge. You know, I kind of like virtual care as kind of an umbrella term, but you got to use those keywords for SEO, right?
Yeah. Well, we'll see if it catches on.
I think interesting just how different companies are doing that, you know, that one-stop shop too with virtual care. So you have like a Roe and a Hims that do it very much to get the prescription. So, you know, Roe and Hims both started in sexual health and then have moved in sort of in different directions. But increasingly are sort of moving back towards the same direction of encompassing primary care. And so everybody's kind of moving into it in a different way. And that's a very consumer-focused one, different from your Amwell or your Teladoc. So I think that we're going to see more and more companies sort of coming into that space and sort of colliding. Whether or not they're all going to be able to do the same, you know, primary care, provide everything, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, of course, providers are still waiting for parity of payment decisions to come out, and that requires Congress, according to CMS, and payers right now, the private payers, are saying, well, wait a minute, what about coordinated care? How are you dealing with that when you do a virtual visit? So there's still questions to be answered, especially around reimbursement, I think, for a telehealth visit, for providers to put in the infrastructure needed to keep it going past the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, while we're on that topic, does anyone want to share any political predictions or anything about how the new administration is going to affect the healthcare world?
Well, we're recording this on the day when the Georgia Senate is still, you know, it looks like it's going to be, you know, two Dem wins, but we're not sure quite yet with Ossoff and They've got some shenanigans going on in the Congress as well that I read are going to go well into the night tonight. So, I mean, it looks like a Biden administration with a Democratic, you know, 50-50 split at least with a tie-breaking vote. But let's not put the cart before the horse,
I suppose. But support for telehealth has been bipartisan.
That's right. Yeah, health IT in general has always been. I mean, some of the biggest proponents historically have been Newt Gingrich and George W. Bush. So.
Right. And I think we can probably pretty earnestly say that even if the Democrats have a 50-50 split, that sliver of a lead isn't going to be enough to push something like Medicare for All through, if Biden were interested in that, which he doesn't really seem to be. But at the same time, there are sort of lower-hanging fruits like patching up the holes in the ACA and shoring it up against a potential Supreme Court challenge that seem very likely to happen under even a one vote majority.
I mean, I'm hoping the most immediate effect, you know, that we feel is going to be, you know, really putting some muscle and some strategy behind this vaccine rollout, which we've seen has been entirely left up to the states, who are, you know, struggling as it is. You know, and there's been no federal funding, there's been no federal coordination, and you know, we're seeing that, you know, some states have not even given out 25% of their allotment so far. So I'm hoping that on that front at least there's going to be some positive, because we really need to get out ahead of this.
I think the Trump administration deserves some credit for helping to get us to the point where we have so many vaccines that work so well. But the rollout is the next challenge, and that's something that, it seems like the ball has been dropped a bit. So,
I think definitely under the new administration, we'll see distribution speeding up. At least I hope so.
So I'll throw it open. Anyone else have another prediction that they wanted to talk about today?
Well, I had a surprising one. You know, we've done a lot with telehealth and, of course, with COVID. But the pandemic sped telehealth, the adoption, in a way that nobody could have predicted. And from what we've talked to people, it's also spurred the move to value-based care, which would seem counterintuitive. But as people have told me, if you were counting on fee-for-service, if you were a hospital counting on fee-for-service to get paid, in most of 2020, you weren't getting paid because people weren't coming in for the elective surgeries and procedures. But if you had a value-based care model in which you were sharing risk in a value-based arrangement, you were still getting paid. So this is spurring more providers to look into value-based care and value-based contracts moving forward.
All it took was a once-in-a-century pandemic to, you know, I mean, we've been talking about this for more than a decade, but it does, you know, I wrote a piece, you know, where I talked to one of the chief strategy officers at Arcadia, and he said that, he said something similar. So he said, health systems and hospitals in the U.S. have been under unparalleled financial strain as a result of the pandemic, and we've noticed that those organizations that have been aggressive in taking downside risk have been partially buffered against this impact. So he said in 2021, we expect these organizations will continue to expand their risk profile when combined with expertise in managing populations and investments in data connectivity and analytics. They'll use the follow-up from the pandemic to expand their market share.
Yeah, that's what I heard from Dave Terry of Archway Health, Mike, too, that confirmed that. And Dave also said that you're going to be seeing more value-based models coming out of CMMI, the innovation arm of CMS. He said there may not be as many models, but he thinks they're going to be bigger and more mandatory for providers to make that shift.
When you think about it, the reliance on elective procedures to finance, in a large part, hospitals' operation seems like not a great system, right? It seems like almost like people who are, you know, a little more well-to-do or have better insurance are subsidizing, you know, the folks who need emergency care. So I can see how this crisis would sort of make you look and say, hey, you know, maybe it would be better if we were somehow reimbursed for all of the most crucial care we were doing instead of having to depend on this sort of weird arrangement.
Well, if you don't have the money, you're on Medicaid, and which doesn't reimburse. And If you're older and you have Medicare, your hospitals are not getting reimbursed for Medicare the way they do from private insurance. So you're right, absolutely right, Jonah. Those who have insurance under their employers are subsidizing a lot of what happens for hospital operations.
Laura, what's next on your list?
So I want to talk a little bit about digital therapeutics. This year, we saw the FDA during the coronavirus crisis loosen some regulations. So some digital therapeutics for psychiatric conditions came out a little bit early. But that means that we saw more and more on the market. And then we started seeing more also get approved. So, for example, Achilles video game, rather, that helps kids with ADHD came out early and then also got FDA clearance. So I think we're going to continue to see that. But what that really brings up is we're going to have more digital therapeutics and prescription digital therapeutics on the market, which means we have to figure out reimbursement model. And I think 2021 is going to be about figuring that out and really seeing what digital therapeutics, how they're going to be reimbursed, and some of those questions around, you know, usage, how are doctors going to actually be putting them to work, sort of getting that adoption. So I think, you know, before this, it was a lot about getting the FDA on board, getting everything through, and now it's going to be sort of what does it look like in practice?
Has the industry over the past year, do you think, become sort of had more agreement about exactly what a digital therapeutic is and what the category entails? Or do you think that's still being sort of shaken out and worked out a little bit?
Well, you know, it's interesting. On one level, I think there is still a lot of companies pitting themselves as digital therapeutics that maybe, you know, the Digital Therapeutics Alliance wouldn't agree with, things like that. But we do have organizations like the Digital Therapeutics Alliance who are putting those definitions out. But I think the thing that's really going to make what a digital therapeutic is, at least my perspective, you know, it's that prescription digital therapeutic, I think, is going to be different than just a digital therapeutic. And that means, you know, going through regulatory and having that prescription element that gets reimbursed, you know, you've got insurance behind it, all of that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think that that could be the make or break in the future is the prescription element.
All right. What's next? Mike, do you have another one for us?
Well, obviously, AI and machine learning, I think, is another area that's going to continue to evolve at an exponential pace. You know, there's so many different applications and use cases, whether it's, you know, training it on the supply chain to gain insights. You know, we've seen, you know, some severe breakdowns in supply chains over the past year, whether it was, you know, with basic PPE or, you know, just other equipment, you know, ventilators. And now, as vaccines continue to roll out and we have to, you know, inoculate a country of 330 million people, it's going to be pretty key going forward, especially with all the specific, you know, sub-zero conditions that need to be had. So we're going to be using a lot of, I talked to a guy who says that machine learning is going to be, you know, key going forward for, this is Michael Biskowski, who's the global VP and head of healthcare industry at SAP. And he says that, you know, AI-powered big data analytics are going to optimize the supply chain, you know, help health systems pre-select and process data in a manner that meshes with its intended purpose and, you know, meet privacy, you know, concerns as well. AI can also help significantly fast-track vaccine development, you know, enable, you know, broader research and clinical trials for these new mRNA-based vaccines. At a more basic clinical practice level, I think, you know, automation is going to be key to, you know, EHR optimization and kind of addressing some of these clinician burnout symptoms that we've seen for years but have only been exacerbated, you know, intensely by this crisis. You know, kind of using AI and automation to eliminate some of the busy work around, you know, clinical workflows is going to be huge going forward. I think that's going to continue to be honed in 2021.
I think one more category is patient-facing AI, you know, triage tools and chatbots. I think COVID has in some cases proven the usefulness of that, especially early on when triage was so important and figuring out who had COVID and who didn't and who needed to be seen the soonest.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I've been talking to revenue cycle managers and directors, and all of them right now, they've either already automated their system, they're in the middle of automating, they're starting, but they're very excited about automation to take away those routine tasks and to for better efficiencies. It seems to be the everyone is talking about that right now.
Laura, anything to add from your side in terms of the chatbots?
Chatbots. Gosh, we didn't have a prediction about it this year, but it is interesting to see. I mean, so much happened during the coronavirus crisis with it. One thing that I found really interesting was, you know, chatbots being able to sort of mine for at-home data and what's going on at home, and then being able to link up with public health institutions. And I think that's something we saw with Buoy Health and Health Maps, which I think is something that's going to continue in the future. I mean, you know, yeah, today it's COVID, could be flu, but it's always been really difficult to get data at home of what people are doing before they get into the hospital. So I think that's somewhere we could really see that kind of grow in partnerships between those companies grow in the future.
It kind of ties into our discussion earlier about the broadening definition of telehealth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sort of the asynchronous aspect of that, too. Well, I think we have time for just a few more. Anyone else have a burning prediction further down on their list that they want to chat about a little bit?
Well, I don't think it's burning, but you already touched on this. It is important as far as the Affordable Care Act, but now that Biden will be inaugurated in 2 weeks, even if the Supreme Court votes down the Affordable Care Act, he can start to rebuild it, especially if he has a majority in the Senate as well as the House. It doesn't look like the Supreme Court is going to go against it, at least not from comments from the Chief Justice or even Brett Kavanaugh seem to be, you know, holding on to the position that it could stand without the individual mandate. But we'll know in the spring, and now insurers can count on that, who are in the market. And providers maybe can breathe a little easier knowing going forward that there will be less uncompensated care and that people will have insurance, especially people if they're laid off from their jobs because of COVID. And even as the economy recovers, it may take a while to get all these people back on employer insurance.
Now, practically speaking, is the individual mandate currently in effect?
No, it has no teeth because you're no longer pay a price through a tax penalty if you don't have coverage.
And has that hampered the ability of the law to function and do what it was meant to do and keep premiums down? Or
premiums have been lower for coverage. There's been more plans. What's been surprising is that people are still signing up for coverage. The numbers show week by week when we covered it this year for open enrollment that people are still signing up for these plans even though they're not penalized for not doing so.
Well, I wonder if the pandemic has anything to do with that. I mean, it's certainly not a time to be caught without health insurance if you can possibly avoid it. Mike, I wanted to check in about cybersecurity. We haven't talked about that yet. Anything you see on the horizon in terms of new threats or new defenses or where that's going to go?
I don't think it's going to be getting any easier. We've seen a massive uptick in ransomware attacks this year, which have crippled, you know, major health systems from UHS to UVM. And as we saw with the SolarWinds thing, which we still don't quite know the extent of it. I mean, it looks like the Russians have infiltrated huge swaths of our government and private sector, and we don't quite know what their plans are. It's a scary world out there. There's no question about it. I think, you know, healthcare has had a pretty steep learning curve over the past, you know, 5-10 years or so, as you know, the gravity of some of these ransomware attacks have set in. So they've gotten better at it, I think, and, you know, certainly major health systems, you know, have their risk assessments in place, and they have their recovery operations plans in place. But, you know, you never quite know until it hits you. I think it's only going to, you know, get more complicated and more challenging, really.
What's the role the federal government has to play in sort of cyber defense, and do you anticipate any major changes there with the regime change?
I mean, I certainly don't think Biden would be, you know, firing the head of CISA by a tweet because he didn't like what he said about the election. I think that will help at least, you know, having, you know, a stable Department of Homeland Security's, you know, cyber division to kind of help coordinate will go some way, certainly. But, you know, unfortunately, the onus is on the private sector to make sure that they're, you know, that they're up to snuff with you know, the protections they have in place. But sure, the government can always help coordinate.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you, all of you. This has been a great discussion, and I think obviously 2020 was, if nothing else, an exciting year for this space. There's an incredible amount of seismic change. But 2021 will be a really interesting building year, I think, in a lot of ways, as we grow and recover and learn lessons from this pandemic. Not that it's quite over yet, but as we hopefully see an end in sight sometime next year. So we will, of course, be covering this. We'll be checking in on these predictions to see which ones are coming true. As I said at the beginning of the show, please do check out the full articles that each of these folks has written. I think there's a lot of good stuff there. And if you feel like we got something wrong or we missed something, tweet at us. Tweet at me or any of the editors, and we'll be happy to engage in a discussion, and maybe we'll talk about it on a future episode. For now, thanks everybody for the time and for chatting with me today.
Thanks, Jonah.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Happy New Year to all of you. And until next time, stay healthy, stay safe.